The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for July 22nd, 2017. We have a rather eclectic mix of conversations today, ranging from a great interview with Assistant Professor Kristen Dieffenbach from West Virginia State University about how you can avoid some of the pitfalls of self-sabotage and how pro athletes become so good at what they do, to how Outside Magazine is beginning to point its lens more at cycling, with the addition of Bike Snob NYC's Eben Weiss and Semirad's Brendan Leonard added to its weekly online offerings. Kristen Dieffenbach coaches, teaches, and is a top-notch athlete herself and offers us some clear advice and ideas about working with our kids as well as ourselves. Outside's executive editor, Axie Navis, explains what the magazine wants to convey and to whom as it navigates print, online, and podcast avenues to bring great content to the reader and listener. Then I've chosen an interview from 2011 to remind you of one of our great frame builders. Steve Garrow from Coconino Cycles in Flagstaff, Arizona is one tough hombre. And while I watch and follow him on an almost daily basis on social media, it's nice to hear his voice again. So it's off to Charleston, West Virginia for a chat about sports psychology with Professor Kristen Dieffenbach. Hi, Kristen. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'd like to start with a little bit of your background, and then we can get into some of the things that are going on right now that sort of will dovetail into what you do.
Sure.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and how you got into the work you're in. It's a pretty comprehensive field of study.
Yeah, I'm at West Virginia University, and I'm an associate professor of athletic coaching education. And my background is actually exercise science and sports psychology. And I got into it primarily because I was an athlete and had such a big influence on me as a young person and growing up and sort of defined my life in a lot of ways. Was a distance runner, became a cyclist, and was just, it enriched my life so much. I was fascinated on how to help other people sort of find that same passion and explore that same passion within themselves. And eventually it led me back around to the leadership in sport, which is the coaching side and the coaching education and professionalization of coaching and development. So that's sort of where I hang my hat these days and where I spend most of my time working.
So you teach and you coach?
Yes. I coach athletes, done a lot with junior and junior development, the 14 to 18 and 18 to 23, the S-block category in cycling is the primary areas I've coached, although I've coached quite a few masters athletes, including a few folks who are in their late 60s and 70s that do ultra stuff. And then my day job is teaching at the university, and I also do some sports psychology consulting with athletes.
Oh, another woman who doesn't have enough to do.
No, it's, you know, there's just so many fascinating things. You got to got to do a little of everything, right?
Oh, I absolutely agree. I totally agree. So let's talk a little bit about the controversy that happened at the Tour de France on stage four. Maybe you can help us understand a little bit of the psychology that goes into the kind of sprint that caused the issue that ejected Peter Sagan from the race.
I'm laughing just because that controversy has just dominated so many conversations I've had. Yeah. Well, and I think that there's a couple of things at play there. First of all, you have a sport that's very traditional and very, you know, road cycling has got some very time-honored traditions on how things are done. You also have some rule changes and some things that they have talked about were going to change as they went into this year and said they were going to try to make the sport a little safer and do some things. But when you go into a sprint, there's an objective in mind, and it's very clear. There's a finish line and how you're going to execute and the things you're going to do. And you have guys that have been racing for a very long time. Many of them, particularly some of our Europeans, from the junior categories on up, and how they sprint and how they execute is something that's just how they do it. There's not a lot of, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z that's happening. It's fast, it's intense, there's a lot of emotion, there's a lot of fatigue. And so they are executing the sprint the way they know how. Similar to many other sports, if you watch hockey, if you watch other sports, where that energy and intensity also carries with it a certain degree of competitive aggressiveness. We're not talking about, you know, throwing a punch because you're mad at somebody. We're talking about just getting fired up and really going at something very intensely. And you can see that in most sprints, particularly in this case. And, you know, the way that the roads are, if you've ever been in a road sprint, you can get very tunnel vision in terms of what you're doing and how you're going about it. So it can become a very, very intense situation on multiple fronts.
When we look at somebody like a Peter Sagan or a Mark Cavendish, or even just a masters athlete who has been mm-hmm. riding or racing, or, you know, any sport for that matter, what are some of the things that these super high-performing athletes need to do to stay competitive and sharp and successful?
Obviously, there's the physical training side of things, right? That they're training to compete and do the things they want. And I think that's sort of the given, right? That you've got some genetic talent there, and then you've got lots of training to hone the different things you're doing. What I think we sometimes forget is that there's also an execution to it, that especially with cycling and running, sometimes people are like, oh, you're just going in a straight line, you're just doing it, it's not a big deal. But the timing of it, when to jump, how to jump on your bike so that you're not pulling the bike out from under you, that you're doing it in such a way that it's a smooth transition from seated to standing as you hammer, making that decision as to when to stand and what gear to be in, and all those types of things are things that really good high-level athletes practice doing intentionally with a mindfulness. A lot of times when I'm talking to, particularly my junior development athletes or the kids that are just getting into the S-ball categories, they're so focused on training and the watts and the sprints that they're doing and how much power am I putting out and stuff, that they forget to pay attention to how they're executing the task, how they're doing those things, what their body position is, how they're sitting on the bike, how they're moving. And really top-level athletes go into their training with a mindfulness of, this is how I want to race, this is how I need to execute my sprints. And it's not just about the physiology of it, but it's the mindset, it's the practicing of the execution, the movement on the pavement to close someone out safely, but to also be able to block somebody in a way, the tactics, if you will. And those are things that people actually have to practice and be mindful about if they're going to do it well and do it consistently.
In addition to the bike handling skills or how to run appropriately or how to swim so that you don't drown in a big
right.
group of people, you're saying that there is a psychological aspect to that training that becomes, does it become, I don't want to use the word automatic, I think that's probably inaccurate, but it becomes second nature, that you know when to jump, you know when to sprint, you know when to, how to handle your bike?
Oh, absolutely. And actually, I often use the word automated with my athletes, because in the course of a race, you might ahead of time talk with your team manager or with your teammates about who's going to do the lead out or when you're going to do that, or in this particular course, is this going to be a long sprint or a short sprint? And you might talk about some of those things. But when it comes down to it and you're at racing speeds of, you know, depending on if you're an uphill or a downhill, you know, 19, 25, 27 miles an hour, there's not a lot of time to be doing a lot of decision-making in trees of if then this kind of thing. So you need to have those things pretty well automated and pretty well patterned into how you do things from a skill performance perspective, but also from a psychological confidence performance that I can execute this, I can do it well, I know the steps, and I'm going to do them. And from a psych perspective, there's also a certain amount of focus and concentration on this is what I am seeking to, this is the process that will get me the outcome, and when I set it into motion, I can do it. And that doesn't happen just because you want it to. That comes with practice and time.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Kristen Dieffenbach. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Yep.
Very good, Diane. You know, that leads me to my next question, which is about sabotage. We tend, I think a lot of people tend to sabotage their own performance either before or during or even after an event. Like, you know, they'll go back, look at it and go, oh, I could have. What kinds of things do athletes do that end up sabotaging their performance?
Wow, that's huge, because I think that's something that happens at every level and so frequently that it sometimes it's a little disturbing when you start talking to athletes. And it's something that I think just recently there have been a number of athletes who've spoken out about their self-doubt and some of their concerns in a, you know, a more public way. Because for a long time it was, if you're an elite athlete, you don't think that way. But again, I think it's a little bit of human nature. It's a little bit of our culture. But athletes certainly beforehand, oh, I don't know if I can do that. I don't know if I can handle it. They doubt themselves. They put more stock in the mistakes that they've made or the things they haven't done and forget to take stock of all the stuff they've done. So I had a bad night's sleep is going to translate into a poor performance, even though the other 15 nights around it were great. I was sick for a couple of days, and they forget that the entire spring was actually really solid training. It was just 2 days that they were sick. In a competition, the kind of thoughts, oh, I can't do that, you suck, the stuff that people have told me when we've talked about their internal dialogues, is often incredibly shocking, because it's usually not the language that they would say out loud, and it can get very, very, very negative. Sort of talking themselves out of or putting themselves down, which can be really, really damaging, even though you tend to be like, oh, it's just myself talking. It really does put a pause on things. And then after the fact, we do a lot of, I could have done better, why didn't I? Focusing on the mistakes as if they are tragic, as opposed to, oh, I could learn from that or grow from that. They equate their mistake to being fatal flaws, as opposed to things that they could fix. Like, I did that, therefore I'm a terrible athlete, as opposed to, huh, that was a bad choice. I wonder how I'd do it differently next time. So they mistake the person for the mistake, and it all becomes just very, very tragic. And those are all three different types of ways that people put themselves down and hurt future performance, or either in the moment performance or future performance, that takes a concentrated effort and some work to challenge and to change those behaviors. And they are changeable. It just takes time and practice.
Well, you see, you work a lot with young athletes, and I know that in many cases, athletes are also pressured by not only their peers, but their parents. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that when an athlete feels as if he or she is really racing or swimming or, you know, performing not for him or herself so much, but for the eyes of somebody else?
You know, I think that that's a really unfortunate common problem. And whether it's real that the parents actually are putting that much pressure on them, or it's perceived that the parents have the best intentions, but the child is so afraid of letting the parent down. What Tom Radeke and some others in the literature have called sort of an entrapment feel. I know mom and dad have invested so much. I know they've put so much time into it. I've worked with a number of young folks who, you know, cycling is an expensive sport. Swimming is very time consuming. Soccer and hockey these days are very expensive. And they get into the sport and mom and dad give up weekends and they travel and they put a lot of money into it. And so, again, even whether it's real or perceived, they know the investment is there. And for those young folks, I try to work with them to find their joy and find out and separate their enjoyment and love and passion for the sport from those expectations around them. Because if their love and passion isn't there, then we have to deal with the situation one way. If their love and passion is there, they're just feeling all those other pressures, that's a different story in what we're going to do and how we're going to deal with it. Is this a matter of trying to help the young person find their own voice and find their place if it's not in the sport, or take ownership of the sport and make sure that it truly is theirs and that the other people are sort of icing on the cake or spectators, not the owners? And so we work a little bit with that. I also work a lot with these young folks to help them see the things that they're gaining and developing, because those things are transferable, because someday they will leave sport, whether they get injured or just get older or find another opportunity or something else comes up. You know, you're young, there's so many shiny things and more doors open for a good period of time there. And try to make sure that they feel empowered by those things so that no matter where they go, they're taking all of those great things with them.
Very interesting stuff. Are there any tips that you might give our listeners when they go to enter an event or begin training for an event or even just want to improve the kind of work or the performance that they are doing right now? So, you know, my goal is to. Are there any tips that you can give them that might just be something they never thought of?
Oh, that's a huge question. So many areas.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. It's exciting. There's just so many cool things that you can do. I think the one thing that people tend to, especially in this day and age, with so many devices that can clock and monitor and track and share, and it becomes really, really easy to get lost in all the data that you collect and to share that data and get the likes and all that kind of stuff. And I really strongly recommend that folks find some time in their training to back away from or back off, turn the device off or don't look at it or whatever the case might be, and make sure that your experience is something that is yours and that you're spending time enjoying the experience for what it is. Now, I know that it's motivating for some people to see other people liking their things and that's fine too, but find a balance between enjoying the experience, being mindful of it, being in touch with it, because again, if you're trying to translate it into that better performance, you really do have to understand, what do I feel like? How hard am I going? Where am I on the scale of 1 to 10? And the device can't tell you that. The device can only give you numbers. You know, the motivation of other people liking your rides and all stuff is motivating. But if you lose touch, that experience being yours, it becomes really hard to assess your goal progress. And when the going gets tough, to sort of make sure you have the passion for it. So unplug a little bit. Find some time to do your sport just by yourself.
I think that's a really good piece of advice. Just to enjoy the sport for the pleasure of doing it.
Even if it's just every once in a while.
Right,
Unplug occasionally.
Yeah, I know people, you know, they'll put a stages crank on the bike and it's like, I always have power. I always have speed. I always have cadence. It's like, back away a little bit. I like that idea. It's like, turn your cell phone off once in a while, right?
Well, and I think that one of the things, and this is not a knock against any of the devices, but with Strava and Map My Ride and all of those, you get into a situation where everything is quantifiable and measurable, and now all of a sudden it's, well, it wasn't faster than last time, it wasn't faster, or I didn't beat this person or that person, and it becomes always about that. And realistically, you're not going to be faster every single time you go out. That's not how training and physiology works. And so if you're watching it every single time and comparing and doing the metrics, you're actually going to get pretty frustrated and disappointed at some point. And so selectively using. Somebody once said to me just recently, make sure you're using the technology, the technology isn't using you. Kind of like that idea, is, you know, selectively choose when you want it and ignore it the rest of the time. It'll be there. It's capturing stuff, but you don't need to pay attention.
I think that's really great advice. Well, Kristen, thank you so much for talking to us about some of the psychology behind some of the sport. I know that we tend to get ourselves wrapped up in all kinds of things that we as sabotage. I think that's the best word. I think a lot of us do that to ourselves. Where can people find out more about your work and about what you are doing? I know you've written a lot of books and a lot of articles and you're teaching all the time.
Actually, the easiest way to find me is through the West Virginia University website in the College of Physical Activity and Sports Studies. I'm in the athletic coaching education part of the homepage.
We will post that on our social media, which you can either choose to look at or not. And thanks again. Have a great afternoon. I appreciate you talking with me.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Professor Kristen Dieffenbach joined me from her office at West Virginia State University. You can find out more about her and her work at cpass.wvu.edu/faculty/ACE/Kristen-Dieffenbach. We're going to take a real quick break and we'll be back to speak with Outside's executive editor, Axie Navis. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU University Heights.
Hi, we're back on the Outspoken Cyclist, and my next guest is the executive editor of Outside Magazine. We're off to one of my favorite places. She gets to be in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We're going to chat with Axie Navas. Hello, Axie. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I've been in the cycling industry for over 40 years, and we've had pretty much the same publications for decades, Bicycling, Velo News, etc. And I've always thought of Outside Magazine as a resource for the outdoor person, for like gear and travel and that kind of stuff. I didn't really think there was a lot of focus or coverage for cycling and cyclists, but cycling looks like it's starting to fit in pretty well with you guys.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, and like you said, we've always considered ourselves the resource for people who love being outdoors, outdoor recreationists, and cyclists are definitely a part of that. So we've had some cycling coverage for a while. Erin Gulley is one of our longtime contributors, and we've always dedicated a big section of our buyer's guide to just pure gear reviews. But certainly bringing on the bike snob, even, has just been, has been great. It's been part of a push to bring more of the cycling culture to the forefront. So we're not just talking about gear, and we're just rounding out that part of the vertical a little bit more. And he is just such a fabulous voice that we're really happy to have him on board.
Fabulous is an interesting way to put it. He is irreverent at best.
Which is one thing we actually really pride our magazine on, irreverent, but also still full of some wonder and authority in a space. I think he really captures the voice when Outside is at its best, and that's what we really love.
Let me ask you a question about the percentage of readers who are cyclists, because I think everybody considers himself or herself a cyclist. Everybody rode a bike when they were a kid. But I mean, people who are taking either cycling vacations or going on a Grand Fondo or, you know, following a cycling ride. Is that a big part of your readership?
It is. When you look at all of those different aspects of cycling, I think we have about 40% of our readers identify with one of those aspects. And so that is one reason why we want to bump up our cycling coverage, why we want to keep some of the stuff that we have already done, keep it really strong and keep the voice strong there. Because like you just said, it's both, you can go pretty on the core end of the spectrum with people who are watching the Tour de France every day, or you can have folks who commute to work or who do the occasional Grand Fondo, you know, to the Cat 1 racer who's training. And so we want to try and speak to each of those people as best as we can.
I have to say, from my personal perspective, that I'm looking forward to another voice in the cycling magazine, I guess you'd put it, space, even though we're going to talk about some online stuff, too. So I'm pretty excited about what you're doing. Is the online reader different from your print subscriber? And I guess we can break that out a little better going forward here.
Yeah, you know, our online readership is larger at this point. So just with all the social platforms and the website, obviously we reach a broader audience than the print magazine. There is a lot of overlap between the two. We have a lot of print subscribers who also read the website. You know, so I'd say, like, in terms of what they're looking for, I think, and what they come to us for, the reader is the same. And then physically, like, sometimes the readers are identical. But that, like, general demographic is the same across the website and the print magazine.
So if you could describe your general demographic, can you do that for me? Tell me, who is your reader?
Yeah, I think like the most general level is people who love the outdoors, who relish being outside and, you know, relish the sports that we do, care about public lands, care about access. So it's like the real, that's the 30,000 foot view. Narrowing in on that, you know, it's someone who's in their late 20s to early 40s for the most part. A lot of folks living in cities. You know, we have a lot of readers in New York and Chicago, San Francisco, where some of these, like, the stories that we're telling are more aspirational. We also have a lot of people in mountain towns, and, you know, Colorado is one example, who are out there trying to make a living in the, like, quintessential outdoor life, maybe trying to make ends meet in a mountain town and a ski resort. So that's like that's the outside reader, I think, and a lot of that probably won't surprise your listeners, but it's just in general people who love being outside and also appreciate literary journalism, which is something we really strive for. We want to tell interesting, good stories.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Axie Navas. She is the executive editor of Outside Magazine. Yes.
That's correct.
That is so cool. What a great position. How long have you been doing this?
I'm lucky to be here. I've been here about 3.5 years.
What'd you do before this?
I worked at, I was the managing editor of a small gear review site, Blister Gear Review, and they do really great in-depth gear reviews on all sorts of different products. And so I was there, I was in Santa Fe working for them before I came to Outside.
Yeah, Santa Fe, one of my favorite places on the planet.
It's lovely.
It is. It's really, and I love the artsy kind of feeling of it. Yeah, I've only been there once, but you don't forget it once you're there. Let me ask you a question about how blogging and podcasting has impacted, if it has, the Outside Magazine as an entity and then as the reader and subscriber looks at it.
Well, we do have a podcast, which we've had for about 2 years now. Peter Frick Wright is our host, and he does a fabulous job. He's the host on the main Outside podcast. And I guess the answer to how that's changed our approach is just that it enables us to tell more stories in a more creative way, and it broadens our reach a little bit. I don't think it's fundamentally changed anything we do. It's just another tool in the arsenal. And we can tell really great stories through audio, through podcasts. So we wouldn't be able to tell as well necessarily like in a traditional long form print format. It's just enabling us to reach more people and to be a little bit more creative with the stories that do come across our radar.
So do you have any sort of indication, and I have the same problem with my podcast. I mean, we've been on the air 7 years, but you can't go to iTunes and say, give me my statistics. They won't do that. So it's really kind of a difficult thing unless you subscribe to one of the, you know, places like Nielsen or one of those statistical gathering organizations. Do you have any idea of how many people listen to your podcast, how many downloads you actually get?
You know, I'm not the person to weigh in with that much authority because I'm not the one running the podcast, so I don't want to throw out a number that the other executive editor at this magazine, Mike Roberts, will call me up and say, no, that's completely wrong.
Yeah, let's not do that.
Yeah, so I don't want to throw something out random, but it's been, everything that I've heard is that it's been hugely successful and kind of more, even more successful than we thought it would be, which is the reason we have kept doing it. And it's just like provided us a really great platform to get creative, which is, like I said, and then also just like try something new, try a new format.
Yeah, it's fun. Actually, I love it. So we did talk about Eben, a.k.a. Bike Snob NYC, and that he is going to be a new contributor. Tell me a little bit about Brendan Leonard. I didn't know Semi-Rad. Who is he and how did you come to choose him?
Yeah, Brendan Leonard is a writer with Semi-Rad. He has a really strong column. Like the other columns that we want to bring on, he has a little bit of irreverence. Pretty funny. He knows the outdoor world really well, so he can comment about things like Alex Honnold and his recent free solo. Like he can talk about that with a lot of fluency, and then he can cover it in different ways and just have a little bit more fun and humor interspersed. He's not writing about these things in a typical 1,200 word news format. This thing happened. Here's why it's important. He approaches it with a little bit more creativity. And so we're just really excited to have him on board for a lot of the same reasons that we already discussed. It's just like another strong voice, another expert in our world who rounds out the site in a way that we really like.
So are you going to be using Eben and Brendan mainly online or in online and in print?
They'll be mainly online. They both have weekly columns. And so that's where you'll see their voices most often, but certainly open to having them write for print. How we view it is we don't really ever have writers siloed in online versus print. It's just like online demand obviously is so much greater. We have a lot more flexibility with what we can run. And so my guess is you will see those voices across the Outside landscape, but right now we're focusing on those online columns.
I guess you already told me they'd be on weekly, or they'd be offering a column weekly. Are you making other changes and additions to the magazine in the near future?
You know, I feel like we're always, in terms of the print magazine, I feel like we're always making changes in that, like, we just had our big 2018 planning meeting to come up with the calendar for 2018. And so that means making changes about what we're covering, the people that we're covering, the packages that we're doing, maybe blowing up the architecture, which just basically means changing the departments or the front of the book pages that we have, mixing those up. So we're trying to do something new, and we're not just doing the same format every month. You know, so those changes kind of roll in and out all the time. With the website, I think it's a similar deal. We're always trying to evolve, both from a development standpoint. We have a couple of new templates coming out, which is basically like upgrading. It's like basically upgrading our design. So that happens on a rolling basis, and then trying to bring in more strong voices. And I think in general, we're trying to pin Outside Online's voice more on a couple of really strong authorities who can speak very clearly to the readerships and to the markets that they are authorities in.
Well, this didn't occur to me till right now, but I see where cycling is starting to expand in your magazine. What is the sport that you think is most followed in Outside? Is that a question?
Yeah, no, I think the broadest is probably hiking, for the reason that it's really accessible, hiking and running. And we cover those both a lot, in that they're really accessible. They're not all that expensive. Access is pretty easy, and I think a lot of our readers identify with those two sports, and you can do it from almost anywhere. And so we definitely focus, like we have a focus on those areas. But we when we're looking at it on a macro level and we're planning out 2018 and we're thinking about what is running on the site, we do want to look at it from that 30,000 foot view too and say, well, what are the common threads that a hiker or a Cat 1 cyclist or a, you know, Hard Rock 100 ultra runner, what do they all care about? And I think we often end up with a couple of what we're proudest of and where a lot of our story energy goes into are these stories that speak to all of those people.
Yeah, a lot of those stories might turn out to be political, it seems to me.
Yeah, I think a lot of them, like recently, are political. I think that's a huge topic. But just so much is changing right now. There's a lot of strong voices in that world, and that tends to lead towards a lot of story potential.
Yeah, you know, right now I'm following the bike tax story that seems to be cropping up in different states. Oregon did it. Now Colorado's talking about it. And, you know, it seems, right? It's like, okay, there's a story
I didn't. Interesting.
What?
I find the bike tax really interesting.
It is interesting because, of course, it's the same old argument. Cyclists don't pay for the roads. You know, you have to kind of shake your head and go, excuse me, we're all taxpayers here. Most of us drive cars, right? Let me ask you something about the future of print. And I'm a paper reader. I love books. I love magazines. And I think a lot of my listeners do, too. What is the future of print? I imagine that your subscriber base is changing, maybe, and more people are going online?
Yeah, you know, like I would love one to have the answer to that question, right? Like, what is the future of print? It's something we think about all the time. I find it really interesting, both on a professional level, obviously, but then also just in general, what that means for society, for this country, for the world. I am not worried about the future of print, at least from the outside standpoint. I think our print magazine is still really strong. Our subscriber base is actually pretty stable. Ad revenue has been pretty stable. Online is definitely growing, and so that's where we see it, kind of like podcasts. It's like it's an older tool that we've had in our arsenal for a long time, but it's like there's a lot of new ways to tell stories through online, and it just enables us to do more of what we have already been doing. And I think that we have a pretty loyal niche in many ways, readership that comes, we have a community that comes to us for the types of stories we've been telling for 40 years. And some people prefer print and they're going to continue subscribing, and some people, and hopefully more people, are going to come through online. And those are people who maybe never would have picked up an outside before, because it does let us broaden our scope. And so I think that those publications with those core loyal communities are going to thrive. And I think those are the ones that are putting their readers first and that have real respect for their readers like we do. And we want to just continue to stand up to their high expectations of us. And I think that ultimately comes down to respect for them and telling great stories.
Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Axie Navas, executive editor of Outside Magazine. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. I want to kind of end our conversation on a completely different note, and that is how you've seen the outdoor industry change, especially for women, in the past. I don't know how long you've actually been in the outdoor industry, but let's just use your, you know, background in it, and how you see those changes.
Yeah, I've been in the outdoor industry about 6 years, so like, I mean, a baby by a lot of standards. But we talk about this a lot too. We think about it a lot. I think obviously women have been in the outdoor industry and leading the outdoor industry for a really long time. I think there are a couple of areas where, I think especially like on the gear company side and on these outdoor retail outdoor retailers that have a huge voice in our world haven't always catered to them, or haven't at least always catered to the women who consider themselves real athletes or like real outdoor recreationists. I think often the gear quality wasn't as good, but that has changed certainly in the last several years, longer than that even, where the quality of the product is equal to the men's, and I think we're seeing a real energy behind that. Obviously, there's been a huge marketing push for women this year. Like the REI Force of Nature campaign is the most is the one that comes top of mind. We had a big women's issue in May, which I'm really proud of. I think we did a really great job. That was featuring all the women who have just been kicking ass in our world for a long time. And I definitely don't see that as this like one-time thing. And I think like outside historically, we've been part of the problem too. You know, we haven't always done a great job covering women equally as men, even though we're not like, we don't really consider ourselves a men's magazine. So that's like one statement I think that we can make, and we're going to continue to make sure we're covering women fairly. That's a push on the edit side that we want to do, starting a couple of years in the past, but just continuing it up into the future.
I'm going to, because I want to ask you this. I didn't ask you this at the beginning. Tell me a little bit about your background. You told me that you came from a different gear company, different gear news source. But before that.
Well, I went to school for journalism, and I went to school at Northwestern in Illinois because I wanted to work for outside. I grew up in a small mountain town in Colorado, and so I've been steeped in like the outdoor. I have only been part of the outdoor industry for not all that long, but I've kind of been steeped in that culture for a long time. And so went to journalism school, worked at a newspaper in Tahoe, a daily newspaper in Tahoe for about a year, which was a great excuse just to like hone writing chops. I think like starting at a local newspaper is just such an awesome learning experience for someone right out of school, because you just write about everything and you write all the time. And then I got that job at the gear review site that we spoke about, at Blister Gear Review. And then I've been at Outside ever since.
So a short, sweet, and pretty successful career, I'd say.
Well, yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. I feel like it's often just like me being in the right place at the right time.
Nothing wrong with that either.
Just been extraordinarily lucky. Yeah, no, there isn't. As long as you can be open to those opportunities and latch onto them when they present themselves.
That is so true. Since now I think I know you a little better, I'll ask you my regular three questions, okay? Ready?
Sounds great.
Okay, what's your favorite food?
Burgers.
Wow. No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, I love burger, fries, and a milkshake. It's very, so American. Like, neither of my parents were born here, but that's just like straight
that's
up
awesome.
American, but it's delicious.
It is, I guess. I don't eat burgers, but I do eat lots of other stuff. But that's so cool that you would say that. You know, Taylor Finney was one of my favorites. He said, a good sandwich. That was his answer.
I agree.
Yeah.
There's flexibility there for sure.
And there is. What kind of music do you like to listen to?
I listen to a lot of bluegrass, like folk music, which is a big category, but like just the mountain music, basically. I love that.
Okay. And do you have any pets?
I do. I have a dog named Topaz.
And what kind of dog?
She's like a Tahoe purebred. She's some sort of terrier mutt that I got at a shelter when I was living in Tahoe. But she looks like a Jack Russell on steroids. She's about 40 pounds. And she's fabulous. She's a great adventure companion.
That's awesome. Well, Axie, thank you so much for talking with me about Outside. I'll look forward to reading. I mean, yeah, how can you not look forward to reading Bike Snob? He's so hilarious. And to learning more about Brendan. Thanks so much for talking with me today. And I hope you have a great weekend.
Thank you so much. To you too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Axie Navis joined me from her office at Outside Magazine. I like the fact that the magazine is offering more cycling content. It's both good for our sport, and I believe it shows an interest and growth going forward. We're going to take another quick break, and then we'll be back to hear an encore of my interview with Coconino's Steve Garrow.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, Visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Hey there, we're back, and we're reaching back into the Outspoken Cyclist archives to bring you one of my favorite interviews. Besides the fact that he produces exquisite frames, Steve Garrow has quite the story to tell about his background and his work. He also makes plum jelly, listens to kick-ass music, and has a wicked sense of humor. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
Steve, thanks for joining us this evening.
Oh, you're very welcome.
This is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think I've done a radio interview before.
Really?
No, I don't think so.
Well, there's always a first time for everything. All right. So I need to know, pronounce the name of your company, which evidently is also your county.
Coconino.
Coconino.
Yes,
okay.
It's Coconino County, Coconino National Forest.
I got
Coconino
it.
Coconino Plateau. It's all Coconino here.
And it's basically the Flagstaff, Arizona area.
Yeah, totally. Up here, south of the Grand Canyon, north of, say, Sedona.
Got it. Mm-hmm. All right. We got that out of the way. So I think you have probably one of the most interesting backstories of frame builders of anybody I've ever met. And you've said some things, you know, in our conversation back and forth in email, and I'm like, holy smokes. So why don't you fill us in a little bit on your background, where you grew up, and how you kind of started out on your own when you were 16?
Yeah, I grew up on an Indian reservation, actually, in northern Arizona, and grew up there in, like, a totally different culture. My dad married into the tribe when I was, like, 11, and I just didn't really jive with the whole family thing and started running away, and that kind of, you know, precipitated into running away for about 4 months and being a cowboy with the Indians, then that didn't really work out very good with family matters, so I basically wrapped up high school and hit the street on my own at 16.
Where relative to Flagstaff was, and I think it was Tuba, mm-hmm. Arizona?
Tuba City.
Where? How far away is that?
75 miles northeast of here.
So you sort of got dumped out on a street corner and said, get a job.
Literally.
Really?
You nailed it. Yeah, with 20 bucks in a duffel bag. You nailed it.
And so what was your first job?
I was a fry cook. There's room to move as a fry cook.
And you're still cooking today. See that?
That's right.
Some things work out.
I still cook.
Yeah.
I still bike.
Yeah, and that's very cool, too. So you've been a firefighter. You've been a cook. You've been a tree trimmer.
Yep.
Mountain biker.
Yep. Baker, stonemason.
Jeez.
Yeah, anything that would make a buck. Metal fabricator, bike mechanic.
So let's start with that bike mechanic thing. You actually became part owner of a bike shop.
I was.
And you learned very quickly that you can't make any money doing that, right?
Well, oddly, the entire time I've been working on bikes since, I think, 1989.
Yeah.
I always said I will never be that guy, the bike shop owner. And then I ended up being a bike shop owner.
It's tough.
It was really difficult. And the most difficult part was I was just in a partnership with someone who I had been a friend with for many, many years. And we had never tried to be partners together, and it just did not work out. So, you know, and
yeah.
I'd been working with metal in the off season a lot and done art my whole life. So it seemed like a natural, you know, accumulation of having, you know, start out as, you know, the flat repair kid and worked all the way up to, you know, being a bike shop owner. And then I was just like, you know, I just really want to merge all of my talents and had always wanted to do this. And then, you know, I was like, well, at a dead end. And so I finally just put the pieces together and took the leap and started putting it all together.
You also did a lot of riding all over South America and
mm-hmm.
all over the West.
Yep.
Were you doing all this on your own?
Largely, either that or whoever I could muster to actually go on any of the harebrained adventures. Sometimes I even returned with them.
What kind of bike were you riding in those days?
Whatever the current bike du jour was, I would go through them fairly regularly.
Okay.
I was riding probably about 10,000 miles a year.
Wow.
I've never driven a car in my life.
And you still don't drive a car?
No, I don't, especially now.
Oh, well, that's true. We'll get mm-hmm. to that, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I think that's very cool. I have a son-in-law who's never driven a car.
Yeah, I had never needed it, and it was never in the budget.
That's fine. As long as you can get what you need, believe me, car culture is not all it's cracked up to be.
Yeah, I don't feel like I suffered nor missed out.
I'm sure. In fact, I think you probably ended up on the right side of that equation. Yeah. You seem like a pretty natural athlete.
Yeah, I was just, and when you ride bikes all the time and bike tour all the time, you've got, you know, tons of miles underneath your belt.
But you also raced the bike.
Oh, yeah, you bet.
How long were you racing?
Oh, from 1986 until 2005.
And is that when your accident occurred?
Exactly.
Okay. Do you want to tell us about it? And we won't dwell on it, but just tell us what happened.
Well, I was hit by a 67 Chevy pickup truck at least 45 miles an hour on my bicycle.
Where were you?
Going to my friend's house for dinner.
Oh, I thought you were in the middle of a race.
No.
Oh.
No. I was riding to my friend's house for dinner. Just one of those riding crosstown things.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So, and so you ended up in the hospital for quite a while.
Yes. I broke my neck at C4, C5. I broke my spine at T11, T12, all of which are fused. I broke 7 ribs. I blew my femur into 25 pieces. I split my liver in 2, split both my kidneys, tore my ureter, punctured one of my lungs. I was a total mess, of course. You know, I looked like I'd been run over by a truck.
Really?
Yeah, almost bled out there, and they took me into the emergency room where my wife had just checked out from work.
Oh, she works at the hospital?
She was in the dressing room, yeah.
Oh, what does she do?
She's a nurse.
Oh, well, at least you have had excellent care all this time. So how long did it take you to recover to where you are today?
Oh, years.
Okay.
That being said, I got hit on October 5th, 2005, and I went to work on Christmas Day, 2005, back frame building.
All right. How the hell did you do that?
I was in a coma for 10 days. I went directly from the coma to ICU, and within 2 days of waking up, I was in rehab.
Uh-huh.
Because I was driving everybody crazy. I told them I had to do something, and I wanted to start getting better.
And obviously, you have gotten better enough to get back on a semblance of a bike?
Yes, I do off-road hand cycling.
And you row, and you kayak?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You're pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And tough.
I have a farm.
You have a farm?
Yes.
So you guys grow a lot of your own food?
We keep it at fruit trees.
Nice.
Yeah. No annuals. Stick with perennials.
Yeah. Well, this planting every year thing, you know, forget that.
Exactly.
All right. Let's talk about frame building a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And that is basically your income?
Yes.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about Steve Garrow's frame building philosophy.
Well, it's just me. I work by myself, and I've always worked by myself, and I'm pretty much always going to work by myself from here on out.
Okay.
I'm not good at telling people what to do, you know? And if I have to check it over, I might as well done it because I've already, you know, done it twice. So
exactly.
It's just me. So,
okay.
You know, my frame building philosophy is pretty much, you know, just I try and build people bikes they like in a timely manner and responsibly, and it seems like a pretty basic job premise, I would say, you know.
What is your basic material? Do you use steel mainly?
Yes.
Okay. Anything else?
No.
Okay. And are you brazing frames, welding frames?
I fillet braze frames.
Okay.
And I do some lug components, but mostly 90% fillet brazing.
I think a lot of people think that all you build are mountain bikes, but that's not true, is it?
I build mountain bikes. I build world touring bikes because I just build things I know. I know ultra endurance racing. I know single track riding. I know world touring.
Tell me about ultra endurance racing.
I race, you know, the usual, I call them small races, but, you know, the series races and such for years and years. Here in Arizona, we would race, you know, Arizona, and then Colorado is right next door. New Mexico has some old races, and we'd go to Mammoth or Park City. Pretty, you know, central or Phoenix, you know, the racing season starts in January and goes all the way through the fall. So I got tired of that and moved on. And plus, I'd been touring all these years, so I had great base miles. So I figured, well, let's, you know, up the ante and moved on to 12-hour races.
Got
50 it. 50-mile, 100-mile, 24 hours.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you do brevets and stuff like that? I mean, were you, like, training for things like PBP or
strictly off-road.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, like the Continental Divide thing.
I really wanted to do that one, and I never did get the chance.
Yeah. There was what was the movie? The Great Divide? Was that the movie?
Yeah. It didn't work out for my whole master plan in that I would wrench on bicycles all summer.
Yeah.
And then it's a ski town at 7,000 feet, so I would get either laid off or go touring. you know, well, I get laid off and go touring, or I would, if it was, you know, I would do alternate years to, you know, go on a big tour
right.
somewhere in the world. So if I was here for that winter, I would do metal work all winter.
Got it.
Yeah.
Got it. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Steve Garrow from Coconino Cycles in Flagstaff, Arizona. So how many frames are you building a year, approximately? I mean, obviously it changes from year to year, but...
Right around 30.
Wow, that's quite a number more than
yeah.
one. You know,
and
that's more than two a month.
Most of them have forks. A good 50% have handmade forks. And then I build tons of wheels on top of all that. And then components, so full bikes. And then I sell custom-built wheels as well.
So tell me a little bit about what you like in componentry today. Do you like the Altegra stuff, or do you like? Are you still using lots of bar end shifters? What are you doing?
Oh, boy. Bikes just run the entire gamut here. There's no set thing. You know, within each of those, different types, you can have, like, a bike with, like, XT cranks and Altegra bar end shifters.
Okay, got it.
You know, so it's kind of just, it's just custom from the get-go.
Who is your average customer?
Average customer is going to be, I would have to say, actually, straight up front, that a third of my clients are women.
Yes, very good.
Yep, and so I'm going to say, given that demographic out of the way, I'm going to say that they're going to be somebody from 35 to 60.
Okay.
It's not their first bike. They either want to ride more comfortably off-road, or they're going on a world tour, and I'm going to say that's going to be like the bulk of the people that I deal with. Either that or like a commuter bike.
Uh-huh.
I do a lot of multiple bikes. People will get a mountain bike and they'll be like, okay, I want a touring bike.
Right.
And I've probably only built maybe 10 real road bikes in my time building, and those have all been for people I've already built bikes for.
Do you build racks?
No. Sometimes, but not really.
Okay. Okay. So, well, when you talk about touring and world touring, obviously uh-huh. they need racks because they've either got panniers or they might have a trailer, but
yeah.
for the most part. How about fenders? You put fenders on bikes?
If people want, yep. I just made a bike with a bunch of handmade fender mounts on it. They were really pretty snazzy. The current one has that. I'm building an S&S coupler bike right now.
Oh, cool.
It's going to go all around the world. I know he's going to take it to South America pretty off the bat. I just finished a frame and fork and a rack, actually, that are going to North Carolina.
So you already lied to me about the racks. Okay.
I know. I'm terrible that way. Be careful what you say. People will want them.
That's
been the way it's went the whole time.
I know what you mean. How long is the wait for a frame?
Excuse me?
How long is your wait for a frame?
It's between 11 and 12 months, and that's been static now for about 8 years. It just keeps it right about, I just maintain the same plane, it seems like.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, I like that. Build one, get it ordered. I like the, keeps just a good momentum.
When somebody says, okay, I want one of your frames, what's your process?
Well, basically, first of all, I go through some questions to make sure that we're both talking about the same thing.
Well, that's a good idea.
Like, okay, you're not looking for somebody to build you a track racing bike,
right?
Right. You know, or something like that. You know, just be like, okay, what are you basically looking for here? You know, just because I build several kinds of bikes and they're vastly different, you know.
Sure.
I build a lot of actually 26-inch wheeled mountain bikes now because a lot of people eschewed those, but they're still widely loved, especially, you know, people who aren't that tall. The majority of women, I'm still building a lot of 26-inch mountain bikes. So, you know, or if someone asks for a 29er, you know, before I commit to it, I'll be like, you know, how tall are you?
Right. I'm 4'9".
Yeah. I mean, right. What are we doing here? And is it both a project that we're going to be happy with the outcome mutually, you know, and before we even get into great details or, you know, how's your saddle setback or anything like this, we got to determine first that we're going to undertake a project we're both going to be happy with.
Sure, I understand.
Then it goes, you know, pretty straightforward. Okay, if you really took progress from here, you know, just send me a deposit and then give me your measurements. Let me look those over. We'll talk components. And throughout the next 11 months or so, we'll finally congeal a thought and we'll make it happen.
How often does somebody come out to you and say, do my measurements here? Or is it most of it done either through the internet or through a phone call? Or how do you work with that fit?
Either or. You know, I think maybe a quarter of my sales are in Arizona.
Okay.
And so usually those people are going to just come here anyway because we're a cycling destination.
Sure.
Especially in summer with mountain biking. And even in the winter, Sedona is only 28 miles away and 4,000 feet lower. So there's cycling going on all year. So
got
they'll
it.
Just make doing a shop tour and stopping in part of the thing. Or people will send in their measurements, which works really fine. We just have to talk to each other and make sure we're understanding the same language.
Okay.
And then there's a lot of people that come and pick them up.
Oh, very cool. So you can do your final fitting with them there.
And they make it like a vacation kind of ordeal. And they come out and, you know, and then they go out bike riding. And we even have a test trail from the house and everything. So,
do you do any suspension mountain bikes?
Not rear suspension, front shocks.
Okay. And whose shocks are you using these days?
You know, I usually Fox with the default. People are seem to either be a Fox or RockShox.
Okay.
Yeah. Largely and, Fox.
Yeah.
They're pretty nailing it really good lately. That's some good suspension there.
Yeah, see, I don't know as much about mountain biking. We basically are a road shop. So, you know, it's nice to hear that somebody's still building a lot of nice mountain bikes. Do you have any new projects coming up, something different from what you're doing, or are you just going to keep doing what you're doing?
You know, this is funny. I'm so resistant to change. all of my socks have matched for, I think, 30 years now. They're like all the same wool ones. I'm kind of famous for that. Like, I don't really change. I just keep trying to perfect my gig. And not really. I see, you know, people are like, aren't you doing anything new? And I'm like, well, every bike is new to me because every person is new.
That's right.
So I feel constantly challenged.
Well, I think that's awesome.
You know, I mean, I don't need a new product. Every product is new.
Right.
You
well,
know, it's a blank slate for every project.
I guess the only thing that sort of stays the same is some of the componentry. I mean, you don't have as many choices there, but obviously every frame is built for a very specific person, so it is new.
Yeah, one of the things that I've been really excited about lately is I've been working with True Temper to draw tubing for me.
Oh, good.
Because if you've seen my bikes, they're, you know, they're curved. All the stays are swoopy. The top tubes are curved.
Right.
I manipulate all this stuff. And so there had been a real glut. One of the guys who was importing the tubing that I used finally retired at 93.
Well, I don't know. He probably could have gone on a few more years. Who was that?
His name was Charles Vogelsong, and he started importing aircraft tubing after World War II, where he was a pilot.
And from where? Where did this tubing come from?
He was from, I believe, Pennsylvania.
And where did the tubing come in from?
He would source it. He had the power to, he would stock over 1 million feet of tubing.
Wow.
And in an old, I believe it was a chicken factory. So he had the power to order enough to get it actually drawn to his spec. You know, he finally retired. He still wanted to go on. I guess his wife convinced him to retire and enjoy his later years.
That is very cool.
I hope he's enjoying his retirement.
Yeah. So you had to obviously find a source for tubing.
Yes, exactly. And it's I'm really excited about it because the product that they've been making here in the United States is really, really nice. So a lot nicer than I'm used to using.
Wow. Better yet. All right. What are you doing for Thanksgiving?
A bunch of my missus's family are coming out from Wisconsin.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm. And,
because it's probably going to be cold.
We're just going to hang out and we'll be down. My shop is at 7,000 feet, and my farm is at 3,000 feet, and they're only 40 minutes apart.
So it's all downhill
we'll be down
from there.
And here it's going to be, the lows will be in the teens, but then down there only 40 minutes away, it's going to be 70 degrees.
Wow, so that means you could go for a bike ride.
Yeah, probably. Either that or boating.
Boating. Yeah, I saw a really cool picture of you and I assume your wife in a kayak, maybe?
She's about the only one who will trust me to get in one, yeah.
Yeah, Brian and I tried it once, and we said never again. We ride a tandem together, but I'm sorry. The kayak thing just didn't work out for us.
Yeah, no matter where a relationship's going, we'll get there faster in a tandem.
That is exactly what we tell people. Do you ever build tandems?
No, I just simply do not have the fixture. That's another one where I'll just default to the experts.
Got it.
Yeah, there are people who have that down.
Well, it's nice to know your strengths.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and obviously you have some. Well, you know what? You're fun.
Thanks.
I'm going to let you go fix dinner, and I really appreciate you taking time to talk with us this evening.
Oh, no worries. It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for giving me the opportunity.
Why don't you, before we hang up, tell us what their website is if people want to learn about Coconino Frames.
It's very simply coconinocycles.com, which is C-O-C-O-N-I-N-O, Coconino Cycles.
And you have a nice blog, too.
Yes, I've been working on it for like 6 years. I think I have almost 5,000 pictures on there.
I didn't have time to go through all of them, but the one that I like is the one right in on the front page because it reminds me of our shop.
Dark and dreary?
No. No, just you kind of peering at that frame from that angle, you know. I can see Brian doing that kind of thing. So it's
I build in a wheelchair, so that's my height.
That works for me.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Steve, have a wonderful evening. Thank you so much again.
You bet.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that's our show for this week. I'd like to thank Dr. Kristen Dieffenbach and Axie Navis for being my guests. I hope you enjoyed those conversations as well as our encore presentation of my 2011 interview with frame builder Steve Garrow. We will be back next week with a brand new show. In the meantime, I hope you have a great week. And if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.